From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of you, our listeners. We're very thankful for that support. For more information on how you can keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, the Buddhist Mahayana New Year celebration spans Sunday through Wednesday. And Sunday night brings the Jewish observance of Tu Batsvat, a celebration of the coming spring. Something those of us suffering from this weekend's harsh winter weather in many parts of the country can relate to and say, come on, babies, come on quickly. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's show.
Our mission statement reads in part, to be an agent of change by building bridges that liberate and unite voices of sacred defiance in acts of justice.
Around the world, we see far too many examples of members of sexual minority communities, as well as other marginalized groups, continuing to live in fear. Sometimes fear for their very lives. A leading organization working to provide both practical assistance and policy direction is the Global Justice Institute, founded by the Universal Fellowship of Metropolitan Community Churches. It's become an annual tradition around here to get a January update from Institute Executive Director Pat Bumgardner. And we'll continue that tradition on this week's show.
History is, in fact, very messy, complicated, and an often confounding investigation into change over time.
There can be no denying the widespread influence of the religious right on our culture, society, and politics. It should be no surprise that we tend to view this influence as frequently negative, particularly when it results in exclusionary, intolerant, and even hateful attitudes and policies. There's also conventional wisdom about the origins of this influence, but an important new book is challenging some of those longtime assumptions. On this week's show, you'll meet the author of We Gather Together, The Religious Right and the Problem of Interfaith Politics, historian Neil J. Young. But first,
for decades, abortion and marriage have been two of the big hot-button topics in American politics. But now, add another, religious liberty, whether it's pastors in Houston having their sermons subpoenaed, or the scores of lawsuits against Christians who are speaking out and standing up for their faith in the public square, future presidential candidates say that the amount of hostility is out of control.
A couple of years ago, we told you about an important report published by Political Research Associates and authored by Rabbi Jay Michelson that laid bare the deliberate long-term campaign by political and religious extremists to fundamentally redefine the very concept of religious liberty in this country. Sadly, in the intervening years, we've only seen an escalation in these efforts. And now PRA has just released a much-needed new report on that subject. It's titled, When Exemption is the Rule, The Religious Freedom Strategy of the Religious Right. And I'm happy to be joined by the author, Frederick Clarkson.
Oh, well, thank you.
Since the last report, I think it's fair to say that progressive social agendas and LGBT rights have made incredible strides. Some people are bound to be saying, so why are you all so worried?
Well, it's a fair question. I think we don't give the opponents of LGBTQ rights enough credit. They saw this coming, and they are people of considerable capability, mm-hmm. both the smarts and the strategic thinking and the resources to find defensive strategies for coping with what they saw as the inevitable.
Yeah, yeah. Well, talk about, if you will, the proliferation of far-right legal groups and their growing influence in this whole culture wars battle.
Well, yes. Since Jay's report a few years ago, the groups that he described, the most important ones being the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty and Alliance Defending Freedom, have grown enormously in their budgets and in just the scope of their work. The Alliance Defending Freedom has a budget upwards of $30 million. And a national network of attorneys has been slowly developed since the 1980s, I believe. The beneficiary of the law schools that the Christian Right has developed at Liberty University and Pat Robertson's Regent University and Ave Maria University in Florida. So the bench is deep, and the budget is big, and they're looking for precedential cases, you know, to test their ideas in court, but also just to keep society mired in legal battle after legal battle at all levels.
They're no longer just saying God wants you to preach. They're saying God wants you to work as a lawyer and protect our country and keep us a Christian nation.
Well, that's right. And in these circles, and people with ears to hear this are going to notice that many of these things, many of these legal groups are called ministries. One would have a ministry of law. The idea of ministry has gone way beyond preaching into how one brings one's special skills to bring about a biblical worldview and a biblically based order, in this case, via the law.
Fred, do you have a case or two in mind that you could point to illustrate the very concern that we're talking about?
One is one that usually isn't talked about very much, and that's the Hosanna-Tabor decision of the Supreme Court, which was widely held as the right decision. And what it involved was a mainline Lutheran church school and a teacher who claimed a disability and went before the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission to with a discrimination complaint. But the court found that her job was enough of a ministerial capacity in what she did on the job as a teacher that they said, well, look, you know, this falls under ministerial exemption, and the church has a right to fire their ministers. And everybody cheered that as a victory for religious freedom, institutional religious freedom. But what the court did was to open a great big hole in the wall of separation between church and state in doing this, because it left open the definition of ministry. Who gets to be called a minister, and who gets to decide? And so what has happened as a result of these legal groups, sharp lawyers they are, have said, well, okay, if this teacher who was barely a minister can be a minister, who else can we call a minister? And how do we then define ministry? And so in order to inoculate themselves against potential civil lawsuits, particularly involving LGBTQ people, but not only, the legal groups are advising churches and universities and hospitals and any vaguely religiously affiliated institution to what they call religify, and which is to redefine your job descriptions, your contract with outside groups, every piece of paper that you can, to define it in the most religious terms you can and to enforce the doctrine internally in order to be able to claim a religious exemption from the law. And that's the door that Hosanna Tabor has opened, and they're running trucks through it.
I want to be sure that our listeners understand precisely what we mean when we talk about religious exemptions. The title of your study is When Exemption is the Rule. When we talk about the fact that the very definition of religious freedom is being changed right in front of our eyes, some people don't understand. They just say, well, religious freedom is religious freedom.
The idea of exemption is that if an individual or religious institution has what has been called a sincerely held religious belief, and that is that they might be able to object to their obligations under the law to do certain things. In fact, even as far back as the Civil Rights Act, you know, the Congress wrote exemptions into the law on Title IX involving federal funds and gender equality. Can't discriminate against women under the Civil Rights Act unless you happen to have religious beliefs that allow for that. So there are places within the existing code, even in the Civil Rights Act, that allow religious exemptions from civil rights and other laws. And new ones are being added via the courts. So the Christian right and its related institutions want to be able to exempt themselves from the advances in civil rights in a defensive strategy so that they can put legal walls around the fortresses of their religious institutions and any institutions they can claim in order to defend themselves against the civil rights of others. Mm-hmm. Now, the example we have from the past, and that is the example of religious justifications for racial discrimination, not that many decades ago in our country, and particularly interracial marriage and interracial dating. Conservative Christianity was using that as an argument, saying, well, God, you know, meant the races to be separate. Mm-hmm. And that exemption was ultimately denied and overturned by the courts and by society. So a new generation of exemptions is coming up that seeks not just to thwart and to limit, but to even roll back the civil rights of others.
What other issues are involved here that people would identify right off?
A number of Catholic universities and archdioceses around the country have sought to limit the labor rights of their employees. Duquesne University sought exemption from oversight by the National Labor Relations Board and said that, well, because we're a religious institution, you know, we shouldn't allow this particular group to organize on our campus. Well, the Catholic mm-hmm. Church is in favor of labor rights and unions, and Duquesne itself has several different unions on campus. So there's a disingenuousness in the way that it's being used sometimes. Another really extraordinary example, and I discussed this in the report, very recent federal court case, there was a Catholic hospital system in New Jersey that had a long-time employee pension program that people paid into and the hospital paid into under the law. There were very strict terms as to how these pension plans are organized. But under the advice of outside consultants and lawyers, the Catholic Archdiocese decided that the law wasn't going to apply to them anymore, and they stopped paying into the pension plan to the point where it was underfunded by $30 million. And religious freedom was invoked there, too. We're looking for a variety of double standards. Aside from the legal details, it's that idea that there's two standards, you know, one standard for us, another standard for everybody else, and we'll decide what our own standards are. Thank you very much.
Fred, the proliferation of state-level religious freedom restoration acts is a leading concern for groups like Interfaith Alliance and others. You highlight these in your report.
Yeah.
Would you talk about these so-called mini-RFRAs, please?
The mini-RFRAs, many of which are modeled precisely on the Federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act, but there's a new kind of mini-RFRA that has popped up in light of the Hobby Lobby decision of the Supreme Court, which allowed not just protections for individuals against government overreach, which was the intent of the original RFRA, but to allow third parties to use the religious freedom argument to not be involved with things which they religiously or socially disapprove, hence the examples of businesses that don't want to do business with gay couples that want to be married, and the florists and the bakers and so on. So state-level RFRAs are now trying to be organized to provide a legal defense for businesses that might be sued in that way. It's a way of the religious freedom argument being used not to advance religious freedom, belief and practice, but to abuse and harm the rights of others.
Yeah. What do you see as the biggest long-term threats of the kind of increasingly sophisticated organizing on the far right that you write about?
We live in demagogic times, and that the idea of religious freedom being a way that a religiously plural society organizes itself, because we know that we differ on things about God and religion, and that we change our minds across a lifetime, many of us, and these can be contentious matters. What does God require? Mm-hmm. But the idea of we're all figuring out a way of living together peacefully and constructively becomes unglued when suddenly God enters the marketplace of ideas in this way. And the idea that people's religious freedom is being threatened freedom to worship God in your way or to advance God's ideas are fundamentally under attack by others, fellow Christians, non-believers, the government, has people pretty riled up.
Yes.
And that can lead to not just the kind of political friction that we're seeing right now, but to violence.
Yeah.
And, you know, we saw 1,000 years of religious warfare in Europe before the writing of the Constitution. And it was with that history in mind that the framers did what they did to try to inoculate the new country they were founding against the ravages of religious persecution and warfare. They knew what could happen. And this kind of demagoguery and the politics that flow from it are very dicey stuff. And that's why taking back, if you will, the idea of religious freedom as a value,
mm-hmm.
as something that holds us together, something we all share in common, whatever our religious differences, is so important and is in such danger right now.
Frederick Clarkson is the author of an important new report from Political Research Associates titled, When Exemption is the Rule, the Religious Freedom Strategy of the Religious Right. It's available online at politicalresearch.org, and we'll link to it from our website. Fred is a senior fellow at Political Research Associates. We also know him as the co-founder of the group blog Talk to Action. Thank you for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Well, thank you so much for the kind words, Welton, and anytime.
Here's a tip. If you ever decide you'd like to be invited to appear on this show, just publish a book titled We Gather Together, The Religious Right and the Problem of Interfaith Politics. While I doubt that was historian Neil J. Young's primary motivation, it certainly achieved that goal, and I am happy to welcome Dr. Young now on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
What do you mean when you say interfaith politics?
Interfaith politics, for me in this book, means the relationship among Mormons, Catholics, and evangelicals, and the ways they've partnered sometimes and sometimes worked separately on behalf of conservative politics for the last, really, 50 years.
Dr. Young, do you remember when Southern Baptists were among the strongest advocates in the nation for church-state separation?
Southern Baptists are such an interesting denomination to study historically because they changed so much through the 20th century. If you think about religious liberty or church-state separation, as you put it, Baptists are really the leading advocates of it for most of American history, and certainly through the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
But what many Southern Baptists meant by that, or at least the implications or the motivations behind it, was really an anti-Catholicism.
Mm-hmm.
And this is true through the first half of the 20th century. The church-state separation is a value and a principle that Southern Baptists are supporting and defending because they're concerned about what they see as the Catholic Church's overreach in the
mm-hmm.
public square.
Neil, a lot of us comfort ourselves by framing the religious right in this country as being at least partially a politically motivated construct. Do you agree or disagree with that, and why?
Well, one of the things that my book does that's a little bit different is to think about the religious right outside of just the kind of political construct that you suggest. And obviously, the religious right is an incredibly powerful political player, or it's been an incredibly important political movement of our modern age. But my book kind of pushes outside of just the political context and thinks really about this in a larger kind of religious and cultural context. And so I start my book in the 1950s, which is a good 20 years or so before most historians begin their studies of the religious right. And the reason I start in the 1950s is because in that decade, I noticed that these three faiths started recognizing each other not so much as political allies, but as religious allies of a sort, religious conservative allies. And they recognized themselves as allies against liberal Protestantism and the ecumenical movement, which was so dominant at mid-century. And so my book really characterizes the religious right as a religious, a cultural, and a political phenomenon, and thinks about how those things kind of overlap and inform each other, but also how particularly the religious lens helps us see kind of the political developments a little bit differently. Because even as these groups recognized each other as allies against Protestant liberalism, that didn't mean that they saw themselves as kind of being religious like-minded, right? Mm-hmm. They still continued their critiques and their criticisms of each other's faith. And I think that's a really interesting dynamic, and one that the kind of political narrative hasn't allowed us to think as much about.
Mm-hmm. We tend to talk about a Catholic evangelical alliance around culture war issues in particular. You add Mormons. Would you explain their role?
Well, the Mormons are an incredibly important group in our nation politically, but they are one that has been vastly overlooked. They obviously came to much kind of attention during the Romney years of Romney's campaigns for the presidency, but Mormon political influence goes back much, much longer than Romney's runs for the White House. And, you know, one of the things that I thought was interesting in looking at the existing literature on the religious right was that all of these works acknowledge Mormons as important players in the religious right, but none of them actually really investigated that history. They kind of acknowledged it in their introduction and then tended to write only about evangelicals and Catholics. And I wanted to bring Mormons into this story as equal players in this story of the religious right's ascendancy and power. On the national stage since the 1970s, the LDS Church has been very, very active in politics that concern issues of gender and sexuality. So in the 1970s, they are one of the leading players, if not the leading player, in the movement to block the Equal Rights Amendment from being ratified. And then the church becomes very involved in anti-gay initiatives through the 1970s and 80s, and obviously up into the recent battles over same-sex marriage. And so bringing Mormon involvement and Mormon political activism into this story was a really important decision of mine, one that I thought was important for really understanding the larger story of the religious right, and I think one that also helps us to think about this story at a national level and not just the regional level, that we've tended to think of the religious right as largely kind of a southern phenomenon, and that by bringing Catholics into that, but especially by bringing in Mormons, we see really the national dimensions of this story.
It's easy to talk about what the religious right has done in damaging American politics. My long-term concern has been what the religious right has done in damaging religion itself. In the introduction to your book, and I want to take the time to read this if you don't mind, in the introduction you wrote that the formation and success, if limited, of the religious right depended on the sublimation, abandonment, and erasure of denominational distinctions, historical divisions, theological disputes, and institutional exclusivity among different and historically antagonistic religious groups in pursuit of political victory and the defense of traditions, morality, and the idea of a Christian nation. I think it is a brilliant, succinct description of what was going on and what it depended on. My question for you is, how do you see that that is being played out?
Well, in terms of your question about its effect on religion, I think that what we see is in the declining rates of Christian identity or Christian affiliation that we see through a lot of the recent surveys of Americans, especially younger Americans, that one of the main reasons, if not the top reason they give, is they identify Christianity with a conservative politics. And they're rejecting those kind of things together. And so I think that that has been an incredibly damaging development for Christianity and particularly for conservative Protestantism. But also we see these answers also coming from Catholics to a little bit lesser extent from Mormons. But no doubt, while the religious right has been an incredibly powerful and influential force in American politics and has certainly pushed the nation in a rightward direction, I think you're right to remind us that it has also had a corrosive effect on religion in America and certainly on Christianity's reputation.
If the influence of religion on our politics is not just strategy, but deeply held beliefs, how does that change the debate for those of us committed to defending a secular understanding of our Constitution?
Well, I think it changes it in a couple of ways. I mean, for one, I think it makes defending or articulating politics in a secular way, I think it makes it difficult in a lot of ways, particularly when you talk about bipartisan discussions or when you talk about, you know, some of these issues that would have been called culture wars in the past. I mean, there's this idea where I think kind of both sides are talking in almost completely different terms. And I think that that's quite a troubling scenario for democracy when players can't kind of speak in the same language. But I do think that in many ways the religious right has not only shaped the Republican Party, but it's shaped Democrats and it's shaped liberals. And no doubt there is a contingency who wants to only speak about American politics from the language of secularism. But I do think that it's also shaped Democratic candidates, particularly at the national level, in having less freedom to speak about politics from solely the kind of secular lens. Now, I think, you know, someone like Bernie Sanders is probably challenging that a lot, but I think through the years, historically, we've seen Democrats really adopting the language and the discourse that religious conservatives have given, and that all of those candidates and all of those politicians are kind of operating within that terrain. And so I think in some ways they've won the kind of framing battle here. You know, how that plays out in the future remains to be seen. But for the time being, and I think for the last 20 to 30 years, that's been one of the big victories, is that they've kind of captured the language and the discourse about these issues and made it hard to talk about things on solely a secular or even in the language of pure kind of constitutionality.
Yeah. Are there concrete ways the agendas that you write about are manifesting themselves in the current political campaign season?
Well, I think that religious liberty is the big issue. And in some ways, I think the brilliance of religious liberty as a political strategy is that it allows Republican candidates and conservative candidates to kind of step away from the individual issues of, say, abortion or same-sex marriage or prayer in school or what have you, and instead kind of frame things in these much kind of more general, but in some ways more alarming terms. And I know that that has been a concerted strategy of religious right operatives dating back to the 1990s, because folks like Ralph Reed, who was, you know, president of the Christian Coalition, they kind of looked at what had happened in terms of feeling like they weren't really winning on their individual issues, and they realized they needed to reframe things. And so that's when the religious liberty language really started getting developed, and we've seen it particularly in the last couple of years. It's really been at the forefront of kind of our political conversation, and I think that's been a way that politicians have been able to continue to kind of engage these issues, but do so in a language that actually, I think, draws in more Americans, because there's a way that religious liberty seems much more kind of a concern of all Americans, or something that isn't necessarily a right-left issue or isn't tailored to particular issues, but has in fact been used to kind of mask a very conservative agenda that is about abortion, that is about same-sex marriage, that is about the kind of standard political concerns that the religious right has had historically.
Dr. Neil J. Young is an independent scholar of United States history focusing on post-1945 religion and politics. He holds a Ph.D. in history from Columbia University and has taught at Princeton until 2014. Dr. Young's insightful book titled We Gather Together, The Religious Right and the Problem of Interfaith Politics, has just been published by Oxford University Press. It is an important book. Dr. Young, I thank you so much for being with us to talk about it on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
My friend Pat Bumgardner has spent decades in resolute ministry to LGBT persons and others who have felt marginalized and rejected by so-called traditional organized religion. A longtime senior pastor at the Metropolitan Community Church of New York, an unforgettably dynamic public speaker, and a tireless advocate and activist. Last year, Pat was elevated to bishop by her denomination. Thankfully, Bishop Pat continues to lead the vitally important Global Justice Institute, and I'm delighted to continue a January tradition here at State of Belief, welcoming her back for an update on the Institute's work. Pat, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you.
What's been going on?
Well, one of the most exciting things for me and for global justice, I think, is the strides we were able to make in Kenya this past year. We actually completed a partnership that allowed us to move our operation out of Nairobi into Matito Ende, which is about halfway between Nairobi and Mombasa, where Reverend Michael Kamindu, our Director of African Affairs, lives. And we constructed a small open-air building on 3 acres of land we acquired. So we now have the first satellite Global Justice Institute outside of the United States. So I was very excited about that, and I was in Kenya in October and met with the Global Justice Committee of this community that is largely built up around a truck stop, and so it's just this wide range of people, and sitting in a meeting with them talking about inclusivity issues and tribal traditions and inclusion and poverty and sex for survival and education of children. It just was this wonderful confluence of people coming together to sort of pursue this dream of what I like to call a world at peace with its own diversity. So I'm very, very excited about that. One of the things we hope to get off the ground in the new year in that location is we hope to be able to offer people who trade sex for survival, mostly women but some men, the chance to use some parcel of our land to raise vegetables and just a small alternative to feeding their children and putting food on the table in their homes, and maybe in that way being able to begin a conversation about who they are and them being welcome in the house of God, and us seeing what they're doing as really about survival and nothing more than that. Then we're going to use that model, I think, for a partnership we're working on in Uganda and a partnership in Cuba, because one of the important things from our perspective is the range of people it brings to the table. And our position has always been that it's people on the ground talking about their own circumstances and beliefs and traditions and navigating a way through that that will really bring social change.
Pat, how long did it take to get you from the beginning of that initiative to where you are today?
Well, it's taken about 4 years. It's a lot of work, a lot of laying groundwork. I know a lot of people get dismayed by the time this kind of thing takes, especially funders, but my belief is laying a solid foundation is really critical for sustaining a vision like this. And also, as I said before, it's really important that it's not something that's imposed. So the learning curve is on both sides here. You know, people like me are invited into a community, and I have a lot to learn about the Kamba people, for example, and their traditions and how historically they looked at sexual orientation and gender identity and how that was changed by missionaries and just where they are now and all the factors that play in that, including money and who's pumping in money to some of these desperate areas to really prevent people from trying to bring their culture together with modern understandings, you know?
Yeah. What else have you been able to get done in 2015 that you want our listeners to know about?
Well, we also have been focusing heavily in Eastern Europe and continuing our work with a partnership with the Euro-Regional Center for Public Initiative and working to link the movement for human equality with women's health care issues and women's and girls' issues. And right now in Romania, we're partnering to counter the Orthodox Church's push to go into schools and use teenagers as the front line of people pushing for changes in the law on family and pushing that law to recognize only one particular configuration of family, and also pushing them to stand up for restrictions on health care access for women. Again, that's a partnership that has been a long time in the making. It's not necessarily an overnight jump from LGBT human rights to women and girls and health care. But I do think it's a connection that makes a lot of sense. And I also believe with all my heart that until we're all able to embrace the diversity of issues we're up against as our common agenda, we won't see true progress. We'll just see, you know, a change here or a change there. But it will ultimately leave some people behind. And I guess I'm enough of a dreamer to think that it can be all of us or none of us.
So well said. You've given us just a very brief reference to some of the priorities for this coming year, but I'd like to hear just a little more about priorities that you've set for the Institute in 2016.
Well, in 2016, we're going to continue working in Kenya and open up, hopefully, a similar model in Uganda and also Cuba, because, you know, with the changes in relationship between the United States government and Cuba, we're able to work in Cuba again. And there are some very good possibilities for us there around HIV and AIDS work. And again, the model being bringing people to the table to talk about what it is they need and what their vision is and how we can partner with that. We'll continue in Eastern Europe. We'll continue in Asia. We're slowly working our way through China, Hong Kong, Taiwan, Singapore, just establishing what some people might call cell groups or house communities, safe spaces for people to have discussions again about how they want to move forward. And we're currently in China. We're in 11 major cities sort of underground, so we'll continue to work on that. We'll continue to sponsor a public policy team in the United States. This past year, we focused on things like gun violence, on transgender equality, sentencing reform, the Iran deal, and developed a course of study on global justice for future clergy that was actually implemented in Central America for people studying for the ministry there. So we'll continue to expand that kind of work and to work with our partners in Costa Rica around asylum and refugee issues. Again, this is a long-term thing, but we're also trying to negotiate a partnership with ORAM that would allow MCCs to kind of form buddy groups for people who are refugees or seeking asylum. You know, there's lots of places that offer like financial aid or the legal assistance they need, but another thing that people really need is to have a sense of community and belonging and someone that can shepherd them through all the transitions that are involved when you change cultural settings in a kind of major way. So we're hoping that MCC can do that. And we're looking at a partnership with an organization called World Hope, and our focus there would be on women and girls. That includes transgender women and girls and human trafficking and sort of diminishing sex for survival. So that's what we're looking at in 2016. In addition to, I'm hoping to convince somebody, this is my one little commercial, that their time would be well spent helping us develop some grant applications. So.
Pat, I know it's somewhat of a painful question, but I want everyone to hear your answer to it because I think it's important. If you had more resources and more support, what do you think that you could be doing right now in addition to the work you're already involved in?
Well, I have several requests from Central and Latin America for partnerships that I have to keep somewhat at bay until I can figure out how I can raise the money. And a lot of those involve things like housing homeless LGBT youth and dealing with the sex for survival and drug issues involved there and re-education and preparing people to kind of assume a role in community life and to carve out a future for themselves. I think we could go much further in Eastern Europe, and our work in Russia could go much deeper than it is now. Right now, you know, we can fund like one person who spends maybe 6 months a year in the Ukraine and Russia. And if we could have somebody or more than somebody there for an entire year, if we could fund their living there, undoubtedly we could just expand our reach exponentially. Because I think I'm not exaggerating when I say you get a lot of bang for your dollar with us. None of our money goes to overhead costs or anything like that, because the church I pastor assumes all of those costs. So every single dollar people give us actually goes into the project or the work. I would definitely expand our reach throughout East Africa and maybe try to move west a little bit. We've done some work in Nigeria, but again, we had to let go of that because of lack of sufficient funding. So I definitely think we could really push ahead, not only the work we're doing, expand those projects, but open new frontiers.
I know you could. I want you to let our listeners know again, if they're interested in getting involved or being supportive in other ways, tell them how to get in touch with the Global Justice Institute and follow the work you're doing.
Well, they can write to me directly at revpat@globaljusticeinstitute.com, or they can go to our website, www.globaljusticeinstitute.com.
The Reverend Elder Pat Bumgardner is Senior Pastor of the Metropolitan Community Church of New York, which has been serving LGBT and other marginalized people of faith for 44 years. She's the Founder and Executive Director of the Global Justice Institute, and last year was elevated to Bishop by her denomination. Pat, thanks for being with us on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Weldon. God bless.
Now it's time for this year's very first installment of the Intersection Awards. Here's where we examine recent events at the crossroads of religion, government, and politics and offer a green light of encouragement, a yellow caution light, or a red don't go there warning. Our producer, Ray Kirstein, has our Intersection Award nominees for this week. Ray?
Thanks, Welton. At an Iowa event this week, presidential candidate Marco Rubio responded to a potential voter who said he was an atheist by saying he, Rubio, wants an America where, quote, no one is forced to violate their conscience, which means no one is going to force you to believe in God, but no one is going to force me to stop talking about God.
Maybe it shows just how badly things are going, but I'd put a green light there because I didn't know actually that Rubio would be that good in answering that particular question in light of some of the other things that he's said. I can only hope that all of the candidates would give the same answer to that question and would realize and help others realize that religion in our nation is made stronger when people have the choice to embrace religion or not religion, to embrace a belief in God or not belief in God. It was a surprisingly good moment, and I'm pleased to see a green light.
So that same voter, Justin Scott, posed a question about the rights of atheists in America at a Carly Fiorina event as well. Her response, quote, no one is coercing you in any way. However, many Christians are being coerced not to practice their religion.
I think she's saying, we don't want you to be coerced, but we do that in order for people not to coerce us. And the background of that kind of statement frequently comes from the idea that there is a war on Christianity, a prejudice against Christianity, an attack on Christianity. And I can't even say that it's absolutely correct to observe that no one is coercing people who are atheists. They may not be overtly coercing them, but they certainly aren't doing anything to assure them the kind of freedom that other religions have, particularly Christianity. Let's go with yellow caution light.
Speaking of religion and politics, a day-long webcast last Saturday titled Free to Believe and hosted by the Family Research Council and deafeningly anti-gay pastor Rick Scarborough. You know, he's famous for claiming AIDS is God's punishment for homosexuality, among other outlandish statements. Featured appearances by 7 presidential candidates.
You know, there are 2 or 3 parts to this particular issue, and every one of those parts deserves a red light. First of all, the idea of the Family Research Council sponsoring the theme Free to Believe is almost laughable if it were not so serious. We have read too much of the propaganda coming from the Family Research Council not to know that you are really free to believe only if you believe what they believe that you ought to believe. Red light. And then the very idea of featured appearances, Jeb Bush, Ben Carson, Ted Cruz, Carly Fiorina, Mike Huckabee, Marco Rubio, and Rick Santorum, red light there too.
And finally, Pope Francis paid a weekend visit to the Great Synagogue in Rome, speaking in support of interfaith solidarity and in condemnation of anti-Semitism.
Obviously, there is a green light there, and I may be giving the green light for reasons other than just what he said while he was there. I think the most important part of that whole event was his presence. We have learned over the years that the greatest amount of prejudice exists against people whom the prejudiced people don't know. I'd say 90% of the people who are scalding the Muslims don't know a Muslim. We have to know each other to begin to value each other. And this Pope, what he said was great. But even more important was his modeling the fact that we have to get to know each other across lines that some people don't ever want to get to cross to know someone else. Green. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. If you've heard something on this week's show that you think would be helpful to someone you know, please share it with that person or persons. Direct them to stateofbelief.com, where they'll find full episodes and in-depth archives, extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. The community that has grown around State of Belief Radio is active all week long, online too. Be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and engage in the discussion. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to tune in next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see, he was.